There's a brand new documentary making its way around the country, and it couldn't be more relevant, especially considering some of the rhetoric being thrown around in politics today. But it's called The Anatomy of Hate. Mike Ramsdell is a filmmaker behind the project. He joins me now to talk about it. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
What was the impetus behind putting together the film?
The impetus was very specifically 9/11. I was out of film school looking for my next film. That happened. I think everybody said, you know, what can I do about this? And I come from a background, my parents, my dad is a social studies teacher and was my social studies teacher all through high school, and my mom is of Lebanese descent. So I had enough of a familiarity with the Middle East and the situation over there to realize it was a little bit more complex than the reaction to 9/11 led us to believe. You know, they hate us, we hate them. Survival of the fittest. But I didn't have any kind of clue of what I was looking for. The question that wasn't galvanized in my head at the time, but that I think was leading it all, was if every individual, if humanity as a collective is looking for a peaceful and prosperous life and one to leave to their children, why have we so universally failed at that since our existence? I wasn't quite that galvanized at the time, but that was really it. Like, it was just very clear a lot of terrible things were going to happen very quickly, and it didn't seem necessary, and I wanted to understand better why.
What's interesting, as you go through all the different groups you looked at, and you looked at a bunch from the Westboro Church to white supremacists and the Israeli-Palestinian situation, is that it's not really just hate, but almost fear, which is such a critical element to the picture.
That's exactly what I think I discovered along the way. I'm not sure that I even believe in hate anymore, other than that's just a broad generalization of certain actions and reactions that we call it. But to dismiss, I think where we as truth seekers, people who are really trying to understand, do a great injustice to these complex situations by dismissing them as an act of hate. I've come to realize that people say the two opposites are love and hate, and I disagree with that. I think it's love and fear. I think that just being a human being is an incredibly difficult thing. I think we're all born with a certain metaphysical void that we're looking to fill, and it's scary. Ernest Becker wrote a book called The Denial of Death, which had a huge influence on me and this film, and he talks about the conundrum that is born into man with millions of years of survival instinct combined with the knowledge of our own mortality. And once that connection is made, once we became conscious of our own consciousness, we had to build these infrastructures that allowed us to live past our own mortality. And through those kinds of cultural concoctions and through developing all of these vices to overcome this original fear, my daughter is 4 years old right now and is just starting to come to realization that mom and dad are going to die one day. She's not going to remember these moments, but you can see that it's very clearly scaring her. And so we search for these things and we build whatever it is. We build an ideology of strength, an ideology of freedom, an ideology of, you know, eternal heaven, an ideology of whatever it is that we grab onto. And when that gets challenged, that fear strikes the fear of that being challenged strikes this chord that causes a reaction that I think we've come to call hate.
We also see that hate can be a rather complex issue. It's rarely, there's not some really old 90-year-old man who just hates everybody. You know, everybody sort of picks and chooses these little battles that they latch on to. And you look at a guy like Fred Phelps, who's the head of Westboro, and His hatred of gays knows no bounds. He protests, funerals for soldiers, not gay soldiers, just soldiers in general, because he believes that it's a punishment from God because the United States is accepting of gays. But this is also a guy who in the 60s spent a lot of time as a civil rights lawyer.
He did. And, you know, if you talk to Fred Phelps, that makes perfect sense to him because the Bible gives express permission to hate gays in the perfect God way to hate gays, is what he says, but it gives no consent for any kind of racism. But if you speak with white supremacists, it's, you know, there's perfect permission to, God says, you know, whites are the supreme being. So the Bible becomes this place of interpretation, which is a whole other conversation. But Fred Phelps, he is probably the most polarizing figure in the film. But I don't think that's necessarily appropriate either, because you have to get to know the guy to really understand what's happening. I obviously do not agree with any ideology that he espouses, and watching him protest soldiers' funerals is one of the most painful things I've ever seen. Having been there and watching these soldiers die, it was incredibly difficult for me to be able to maintain any kind of civility with them. That being said, when I got to know him, what I got to know was a man who believes wholeheartedly in the Bible, that it is the direct handwritten word of God. If it is the direct handwritten word of God, and it has certain passages that can be, that God does hate, you know, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, et cetera, and if you are supposed to go out and tell the sinners that they're sinning, then what he's done is he's just taken a very specific interpretation of the Bible and is living it in the way that he thinks is absolutely necessary and the best way to do it. Do I agree with it? No. Do most people agree with it? No. But I think we all do that. I think we all interpret what our role is, whether it be through religious or secular definitions, and try to live them to their fullest. So once you do that, it doesn't make you necessarily, you know, you certainly don't agree with the ideology, but it takes the venom out of it. It makes it more relatable. It makes it more understandable. It makes it interpersonal. And that I think, is the incredibly difficult journey that we have to collectively make, where we take the venom out of these things, where we don't project onto him the same thing that we're condemning him for projecting onto others. We don't turn him into a stereotype of our shadow demons. We say, here's this guy who is incredibly intelligent, who is incredibly well-spoken, and is incredibly passionate. And in the 60s, he would have been a hero to us, and now he is this villain. Well, why is that? What is so specific about the mechanisms in me that is allowing me to kind of make these huge jumps with one individual? And I think once we make that journey, that's the journey that I had to make making this movie. I didn't know I was going to go through that. And honestly, Fred Phelps was the one who really put that in front of me. When I sat with them, and, you know, you have hot chocolate with the kids and you see people eating Cheetos and just arguing about everyday stuff that got argued about in my house, and you have to reconcile that with these signs and this venom and all of this very difficult, painful stuff. Again, it doesn't necessarily make anybody less appropriate, or you certainly don't agree with their messages anymore, but it does take the venom out of the stereotype and just makes them a human being.
You got close to some pretty, I think I could safely say, despicable people, and Fred Phelps isn't the only one. But I wonder, they're always skeptical of outsiders, especially, you know, filmmakers, members of the media, because they feel like they're not going to properly represent their views. How were you able to gain their trust to get them to allow you in?
Well, quite honestly, because I did not ever refer to them as, if I can say, despicable people. That was never my intention. And a lot of them didn't. I mean, you know, nobody's in the movie who didn't let me film them. There's a lot of people who said, I don't want you anywhere around me, or you're just part of the media, et cetera, et cetera. But my intention was never to judge. My intention was never to stereotype them in the way that everybody knows them to be. You know, to have Billy Roper, a white supremacist, just portray him as a white supremacist is not interesting. You know, okay, you're a white supremacist. You say really offensive things, and great, now we know you're out there. Now all I've done is just add to the fear-mongering that goes on. You know, these guys are scary, et cetera, et cetera. So and there was other cameras around at certain times, and you could see people trying to get the soundbite out of them, you know, say something really offensive, et cetera, et cetera, and they would just walk away from those guys. But it was never my intention. My intention was to understand. That's the only productive way to move forward, I think, in this whole environment we call 2009, is to try to understand these people who scare us, who say things that we just cannot find any grounds for respect whatsoever. And in doing that, I certainly wouldn't say that I developed friendships with people, but what I did is I saw them as people, and they saw me as a person. And it was it was a relationship built on that. Let's try to understand each other. And they've all seen the movie, and obviously, you know, I didn't make a movie that supported their ideology, but they respected the fact that I made a movie that didn't try to condemn them or stereotype them. And I think that came through in my relationships with them, and that's what allowed me the kind of access that I got.
What's your take on the elements that we're seeing emerge on the right now that are not just expressing opposition to, but rather a hate and a vitriol towards the president?
Well, I think that America has whipped itself into such a fear. I think that fear has been used in this country for so long as an appropriate tool to galvanize people, that once that fear gets going, it just needs an outlet, whether that outlet be communists, whether that outlet be terrorists, whether that outlet be Asians, whether that outlet be liberals, the other side. Fear is the enemy, and all it needs is just a symbol to be projected on. If we'll take it out of the U.S., and we'll take it, we'll use an example with the white supremacists. If tomorrow, and this is one thing that I always talk with them about, if tomorrow somebody waved a flag and they got their all-white nation, it would be the very next day that they were all at war with each other. Who was more white? Who was the proper white? Who was this? Who was that? Because it's not non-whites who are their enemy or that make them feel the way they do. It is the massive amount of fear that lives inside each one of them. So the more, this is what is so frustrating to watch happen, as the media, as politics, as advertising, as everybody jumps on this fear bandwagon and uses it, because it's an incredibly powerful tool, what people don't realize is we are polluting the collective ether with such an amount of fear that there is no way that rational thought can take hold. And if you ever needed proof that we're all connected, you need not look any further than the way that this fear works through a collective, through a society, through a nation, through a globe. You know, oh, yes, we went through a recession. Yes, it's been terrible. But to bang that drum as hard as we do without any kind of productive, rational process behind it, to use these two wars as, yes, there's difficult decisions that need to be made when people attack you, but let's make it rationally. Let's make it intellectually. Let's discuss what's happening here. But what we've done is we've just turned everything into a soundbite, the fastest soundbite, because people biologically are programmed to survive. That's not our fault that we respond to fear. That's the way we're programmed. And one of the quotes in the movie is, it takes an incredible intellectual effort to overcome those responses. And that is what we should be working on, is those intellectual efforts to overcome that primitive fear response. And I think that there are some who are in very powerful positions who should be far more careful with the way they use fear. It might get you elected, but look at all of the damage it does. It might sell your product, but look at all the damage it does. And until we understand how damaging, because fear does not allow for rational thought. When you're in a state of fear, you have one job and one job only, and that is to survive at all costs. And the more we perpetuate fear in this collective ether we call the United States, the less and less rational we're going to see people behaving, and you're going to see more things like we're seeing now. And I think it's incredibly irresponsible for people who know better to be espousing it the way that they are just to achieve the means that they set out for.
The film is Anatomy of Hate, A Dialogue for Hope. Mike Ramsdell is the man behind it. You can go to anatomyofhate.com. You can find out information on screenings, news about the movie. You can start dialoguing about it as well. Mike, I want to thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you very much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
What is it about Flint that makes documentary filmmakers?
Yeah, interesting, huh? I'm the other Mike from Flint, I guess. I don't know. Maybe there's something in the water, but it is a town that prides itself on its political and attention to what's happening in the world. So I don't know. Maybe. And there's a bar there called El Toro's. If you want to have a good political conversation, go sit at El Toro's. If somebody will drink a beer with you and talk about any topic you want to talk about.